Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the very latest in-depth interview from peterbcollins.com. This one's special. You're about to hear the voice of an out-progressive, a woman from Maine, a candidate for the United States Senate, who spent 8 years running the ACLU branch in Maine, is a real champion for restoring our constitutional rights. And she also helped lead the charge for marriage equality in the state of Maine. She really matches me on so many of the issues, as you'll hear in this forthcoming hour. Her name is Shenna Bellows, and I hope you will spread the word that there's a real progressive running for the Senate this year. I always open with thanks to the people who support this podcast, and let's single out two people in Maine who've been stalwart supporters. Stuart Smith, a longtime subscriber, and even longer is Del Leonard, who has served as our unpaid vice president for marketing in the Northeast United States for some time now. Del, Stuart, thank you for your support, and I hope you'll be supporting Shenna Bellows. If you're not a subscriber, trip on over to peterbcollins.com and follow the links under my picture on the homepage that say sign up. You can choose $5, $10, $20 a month, or our best deal, the $50 annual subscription. New annual subscribers get rewarded with bonus gifts, like a bag of kick-ass Kona coffee beans. They come from the Big Island of Hawaii and our friend Russ Archibald. And we've got the latest rock and roll CD from John Dist called Red Flag, with some politically potent rock and roll tunes in there. So sign up today at peterbcollins.com. Also, if you go to my website, follow the banner ad to audible.com. And if you sign up for their free 30-day trial, they'll give you your free audiobook download absolutely free and pay me $15 for referring you. It is a no-lose, win-win-win-win-win situation, and I hope you'll take advantage of it. Today's program is especially for our listeners in Maine, Stuart Smith and Del Leonard, among many others.
As I was walking a ribbon of highway, I saw above me an endless skyway. I saw below me a golden valley. Yeah, this land was made for you and me.
That's Everclear's rockin' version of This Land Is Your Land. And today, I'm delighted to present a candidate for the United States Senate who, by all the accounts that I've seen, represents the kind of progressive voice that is so desperately needed in this country. I'd like you to meet Shenna Bellows. She is a Democrat on the ballot and facing no primary opponent in the June primary. And this is in the race against Susan Collins, a longtime member of the United States Senate from the great state of Maine. Shenna Bellows, thank you for joining us today.
It's a pleasure. I'm glad to be here.
Now, I want to run down your background quickly because you went to public schools in Maine. You went to Middlebury University. My brother and sister-in-law went there. You were a Peace Corps volunteer. And then you hadn't done enough, so you spent another year with AmeriCorps Vista. I've worked with many AmeriCorps Vista volunteers as interns over the years, and none of them disappointed me. They were all interesting young people, really dedicated to making change. You've spent the last year, last 8 years, running the American Civil Liberties Union office in Maine. And that warms my heart because I really want to see us return to constitutional rule in this country. You have championed marriage equality, leading the charge in the state of Maine. And I'm from San Francisco, where all that started 10 years ago on Valentine's Day. So there are many more issues that I want to cover with you. But tell me why you're running for the Senate. And now that, I've extolled your virtues, what is it you want to achieve if you get to Washington?
Well, thank you for that introduction. And I am running for the United States Senate because I'm passionate about positive social change. I think that we need change on the environment with regards to climate change, the greatest threat that our planet faces. We need to restore our constitutional freedoms, to restore individual liberty and public trust in government again. And we need a different approach to the economy to address rising income inequality, to give working class people a chance. So I'm running because I think we need more courage and honesty in our leadership in Washington. And the only way we can make a difference is by getting involved.
So, Shenna, was it tough for you to leave the ACLU to run for this office? Because, you know, running a campaign is extremely difficult. For me, the hardest part is asking people for money and maintaining your integrity in that process. And so even as you articulated the need to fix our system and to bring the voices of real people up to match the amplified voices of corporate America, you've got to get your hands dirty and get into this really grungy system that we have in order to get elected.
It's true. And it was. It was a very difficult decision to leave the ACLU because I loved working at the ACLU, whose mission is defense of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. No more patriotic mission in the country. And we had a great team. We were working on great issues. In 2012, we won same-sex marriage. We had a successful campaign to reduce solitary confinement in Maine State Prison. Mm-hmm. I co-chaired a statewide referendum campaign to restore same-day voter registration. It is a wonderful organization. But I was working on the issue of privacy last year, and we were successful in Maine. We were one of two states in the country to require that law enforcement access a warrant before accessing location information or your email communications or text messages.
Now, wait a minute, Shenna. Didn't you get the memo? Dick Cheney declared the Fourth Amendment optional after 9/11 because it changed everything and we have to go to the dark side.
Ugh, you're so right. And the USA Patriot Act and then multiple pieces of legislation, the FISA Amendments Act of 2008, time and time again, this Congress and the executive branch have expanded government surveillance powers and infringed on civil liberties. So to fight back in Maine successfully, to put together a right-left coalition with Republicans, Democrats, Independents, Greens, working together on privacy was wonderful. But after the bill passed and we were celebrating, you know, our governor, Paula Page, who is terrible, vetoed the bill, and we were successful in a veto override, someone asked me, well, isn't the real problem at the federal level? And I had to admit, they were right. So many of these environmental problems, economic problems, and constitutional liberties problems stem from a lack of action by Congress or actions that have harmed our liberties and our way of life.
Mm-hmm. And Shenna, you know, I really appreciate hearing that because too many Democrats have silenced themselves because there's a Democrat in the White House and the same policies that caused them to publicly challenge President Bush have been extended by Obama, if not cemented into place. And let me just give you an example. I have a friendly relationship with Senator Barbara Boxer of California. I've known her since she was in Congress back in the 1980s. And she was a champion, along with Russ Feingold in 2008, fighting the renewal of the FISA Act, the so-called FISA Reform Bill of 2008. And candidate Obama said he would vote against it if it included immunity for phone companies. It did, and he didn't keep his word on that. And Barbara Boxer was a real advocate for our constitutional rights at that stage. Fast forward to the end of 2013, we've got that fiscal cliff, phony drama playing out, and Senator Feinstein rams through a 5-year extension of the FISA law. She spurns amendments from two members of her own party, Merkley and Wyden of Oregon, and spurns an amendment from Rand Paul. Maybe you can just call that politics. But Senator Boxer didn't vote on any of those amendments and didn't vote on the 5-year extension of the FISA law. And I've called her office and said, where was Barbara? And nobody can tell me. And I chalk that up to what I call Leflon. Reagan was the Teflon president, and Obama is the Leflon president. DuPont made this special stuff so that nothing that comes at him from the left sticks. And Barbara Boxer, for better or worse, appears to be a casualty of that, because she went silent on the extension of the FISA law.
I think that you're absolutely right that we need to adhere to our core principles and our core values, no matter who the president is. And President Obama's actions on surveillance have been very disappointing. And Congress has failed to place checks and balances on that executive power. It's really up to Congress to reform the laws, to repeal the Patriot Act, to stop the NSA abuses of power, and Congress has abdicated its oversight authority entirely. We can celebrate the good work that Obama does, his call to raise the minimum wage, his work on civil rights and same-sex marriage, and still criticize the issues with which we disagree. And that's, you know, for me, a big one is the issue of NSA spying. I think that that is intellectually honest, and I think it's important to our democracy to have civil dissent and discussion and debate about these issues rather than groupthink.
Well, Shenna, I fully agree, and I believe that the Fourth Amendment is one of the clearest of the 10 elements of the Bill of Rights. You know, it's not like there's a dangling participle there that makes it, do you need a militia? No. I mean, the Fourth Amendment is quite explicit. And it really troubles me that a man trained in constitutional law has spun it up as you know, metadata, don't worry, we're not listening to your calls. And Edward Snowden has confirmed much of the work that I've done with whistleblowers over the last 5 years. And Shenna, let me just give you one example. After Ed Snowden surfaced, Russell Tice, who was a high-level NSA official, explained to me that he personally was involved in the installation of wiretaps on Senator Feinstein, her homes, her offices, her staff, on members of the Supreme Court, including Sam Alito after he was nominated to the bench. He went on to say that he participated in the wiretapping of a man named Obama back in 2004 when he first surfaced as a candidate for the United States Senate. I don't want to put any extra fear in you, but based on that model, we might be entertaining an NSA monitor right now as we have this conversation on Skype. And the larger point of what Tice revealed is that what J. Edgar Hoover did with paper files is being done or could be done by the NSA now, where Keith Alexander is at the top of the heap and can analyze the phone calls, the intercepts of many top elected officials. I don't have any proof that any of them have been compromised, but the sheer potential of it is obvious, and I am stunned that we're not seeing more pushback and a call for something like the Church Commission to really deal with, expose the wrongdoing, and fix these policies.
We absolutely need a modern-day Church Commission, a congressional committee to investigate the nature and extent of surveillance, much of which we know about already because of Edward Snowden's revelations, but also to ensure that we put in place checks and balances and say, again, there must be limits, because you're right, technology has exceeded the development of our laws to place a check on that. And this philosophy of total information awareness, which is a philosophy that the executive branch has embraced since September 11th, the idea that if they just have as much information as possible about everyone and their movements, their communications, their conversations, that they can then identify patterns somehow and prevent criminal or terrorist activity in that way. Well, there are two problems with that. One, the Fourth Amendment freedom from unreasonable search and seizure that is explicit about your right to be left alone, your right to go about your daily life free from surveillance. And the Fourth Amendment is explicit. No warrant shall issue but upon probable cause. There, embedded in the Bill of Rights, is this concept of court oversight. So we absolutely need a modern-day church commission to investigate these abuses of power. And what you describe is not only possible, it's probable. And it's very concerning because the consequences of such power concentrated in the executive branch are very concerning to our democracy.
And Shanna, my concerns are start at the NSA, but expand well beyond that. The FBI is a rogue agency, and national security letters allow individual agents to write their own warrants, and there is very little oversight. The Inspector General of the FBI, year after year, has said that there is massive abuse of national security letters. We don't know what 15 other intelligence units of our surveillance community all report to a man who's now a proven perjurer, James Clapper, the director of national intelligence. And so, you know, I want to make sure that we don't allow the micro focus on NSA to obscure that there are other issues, like the National Defense Authorization Act with its draconian detention clause, like the fact that we still have not seen the Justice Department memos that purport to give a legal sanction to the president's Tuesday meetings where they decide who is next to be killed by a drone strike, up to and including that there's this open discussion now about whether or not they're going to kill an American who they think is in Pakistan. And, you know, there's a whole range of issues. And my concern is that by focusing solely on the NSA, that we may have narrow reforms there and the rest of that community runs rampant without any check.
I was part of an FBI spy files project when I was at the ACLU, starting back in 2005. And, you know, I was in a conversation with a church leader one day in Maine, and he said, you know, is it crazy or is it possible that some of my peace activities against the war in Iraq are being monitored? And I said, well, actually, there's a national ACLU initiative to investigate the nature and extent of FBI surveillance of peace activists, and we can absolutely participate and request your spy file. So we did proceed with that on behalf of a number of activists in Maine. And what we found was, in fact, that in Maine, the FBI had started a file on the Eastern Maine Peace and Justice Center, which is a peace center in Bangor, Maine, a very small group of committed activists, very peaceful, nonviolent activists. And the contents of the file were not alarming per se, but the existence of a file, the fact that the FBI had taken the time to look into the Eastern Maine Peace and Justice Center in Bangor, Maine, an infringement on those citizens' fundamental constitutional rights, and a huge waste of taxpayer money. You know, in this difficult economy, when we're facing nationwide cuts to education, cuts to programs like Head Start, where there are so many difficult challenges facing us, and for the government to be spending billions of dollars on surveillance, and you're right, it's not just the NSA, it is the entire surveillance industrial complex is what I've been calling it.
And there's much more we could talk about, but I want to shift to other topics. I do appreciate the work you've done on restoring constitutional rule here, and I know that'll be a key element should you be elected to the Senate. I want to turn next to the bizarre fiscal arguments that we have, because we have the Tea Party extremists who have repeatedly shut down the government or staged these kind of extortion attempts, and the president's gotten better at handling that. He finally has abandoned the grand bargain where he served up cuts to future increases in Social Security payments without, you know, any offset from the other side. He was negotiating with himself. But what strikes me as so bizarre is that all of these discussions about cutting the operating deficit and reducing the long-term debt never approach any meaningful cuts at the Pentagon. And so I ask you, what would be your approach to the Pentagon budget? And do you see room to substantially reduce our spending there and redirect those dollars to rebuilding the United States?
Yes. I was recently endorsed by the Council for a Livable World, which is working toward peace and security issues internationally and working toward a vision of a nuclear weapons-free world. And we are really at a turning point in this country with an aging nuclear weapons stock. And as a country, we can either invest more money in safeguarding that stockpile and updating those weapons, or we can begin to retire our nuclear arsenal. And unfortunately, in the last budget that Congress just passed, they made the wrong decision. They decided to invest in nuclear weapons that the Defense Department isn't even requesting. And I think it's the wrong trend. It's the wrong direction. So I do think that we need to cut the military budget significantly. And I do think that we need to make smart choices about the budget and the deficit. But you mentioned Social Security, and that's a perfect example. Social Security is solvent. And if we were to scrap the cap, if we were to make sure that higher income earners continue to contribute to Social Security, we could expand Social Security benefits, which is something we desperately need to do because seniors in Maine are going hungry because they cannot afford heat in this very cold winter here and food and rent and medicine. We need to do that. And it's something that could be fiscally responsibly done, but there has been a lack of leadership. I mean, fortunately, there are senators like Senator Elizabeth Warren and Tom Harkin who are pushing to expand Social Security benefits and for a fiscally responsible and also progressive approach to this economic policy.
Mm-hmm. What is your position on the Affordable Care Act? In your view, can it be amended to move more people into Medicare in a single-payer model? Are we kind of stuck with what has been laid out here, which to me is a big boon to the insurance, the for-profit insurance companies? It continues protectionism for the pharmaceutical industries. And, you know, I'm one of those people who are inaccurately cited by Republicans who say 70% of the public is opposed to Obamacare. Well, I'm only not in favor of it because it doesn't go far enough. And because of what I just cited, that it's a corporate fix as opposed to a Medicare model, which would have much lower overhead costs and have much more of an effect of trying to drive down increases in both insurance and the underlying health care costs.
I, too, support universal single-payer health care. And I think that the healthcare crisis in this country is unconscionable, particularly when you look at other nations that do provide, through universal single-payer systems, healthcare for all. And I think that's where we need to go. I think the Affordable Care Act, in terms of expanding coverage, was a step in the right direction. And I think there are benefits to the Affordable Care Act, things that should have been done long ago. I support, for example, and thank goodness this happened, but the prohibition on insurance companies denying you coverage based on a pre-existing condition. I think the idea that young people can stay on their parents' plans until age 26 is hugely important, especially in a state like Maine, where young people graduating from college are facing double-digit unemployment, much higher than the general population, and combined with it a significant student debt burden.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think that there are aspects of the Affordable Care Act in terms of expanding access and in terms of some of the coverage requirements that are positive. But when you talk to, you know, I think there are aspects of it that you're absolutely right, were giveaways to the big insurance companies. For example, how on earth they passed the Affordable Care Act and at the same time allowed insurance companies to drop people from their existing policies and then try to sell them much more expensive policies, I think was politics at its worst and compromise at its worst. Similarly, I think that the individual mandate in rural Maine has been very concerning to low-income people who are living on the edge, paycheck to paycheck. The tax credit system, the subsidy system is complicated, and for people who are living on the very edge, who are struggling to make ends meet, it is incredibly intimidating, and getting some sort of tax benefit, you know, at the end of the year does not comfort them. So I think that there are significant problems with the Affordable Care Act. I am an optimist. It's why I'm running for the United States Senate and deciding to go down into Washington with all of its problems. So I do think that any legislation can always be amended, but I also think that we need to work toward universal single-payer healthcare.
And I also freely admit that the politics of it have been so complicated by the obstructionists in the Republican Party. And it's been tough for single-payer advocates because, you know, I don't want to give aid and comfort to those who are simply seeking to allow people, as Alan Grayson said, to die. That's the Republican health care plan. On the other hand, there are many thoughtful people who were not heard when Max Baucus ejected them from the Senate hearings on health care, and when John Conyers had to beg to be invited to the White House to one of the kickoff meetings about health care reform. And so it's been a problematic path. And, you know, I'm happy to see more people covered. But I think that there are huge political liabilities, as you suggested, with the mandate. I understand the policy reason for the mandate. But ever since it was proposed, I said, wow, you know, the right is going to seize on that and turn this into some sort of a twisted, misguided issue about personal liberty. Let me turn next to combining two issues where federal and state laws are out of sync. We already touched on your crusade for marriage equality in Maine, and we now have issues that are being sorted out about how states that don't yet allow same-sex marriage have to deal with those who were married in other states. Benefits, divorce, property issues, there are many things that stem from it. Likewise, we have states like California that have legalized access to marijuana for medical or quasi-medical purposes. We have Washington and Colorado that have flatly legalized it. And the Obama administration is taking tepid steps to regularize banking issues so these places that sell marijuana don't have to also sit on big stashes of cash. The problem is that marijuana is a Schedule I drug. And when it's marriage equality, the problem is we have people who want to impose their moral values on the entire population. So how do we deal with these inequities between state and federal law and the emotional ties that people have to the status quo?
When it comes to civil rights and civil liberties under the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, we should have federal standards. We should have a nationwide freedom to marry. Same-sex couples all across this country should be able to have the legal rights and protections of marriage. And I was really proud to work with groups like Equality Maine, Gay and Lesbian Advocates and Defenders, in a wonderful coalition campaign to win the freedom to marry in Maine. I worked on that campaign for 7 years as a member of the executive committee. And we were able to change hearts and minds through a very organized grassroots campaign. But at the federal level, we need real leadership. And this is a key difference between my opponent and me. Republican Susan Collins, despite representing a state that has passed the freedom to marry on the ballot, has refused to say whether she will support the freedom to marry. She says it's a state's rights issue. Well, discrimination should never be left up to the states, whether it's racial discrimination or discrimination against our gay and lesbian friends and family members. With regards to marijuana legalization, we need to treat marijuana in the same way that we treat alcohol and tobacco. And that means that we need to decriminalize marijuana. And I am a proponent of legalization. I understand I was endorsed by the Marijuana Policy Project in Normal because I understand I'm the first U.S. Senate candidate in the country to come out so strongly for marijuana legalization. But I think it's important from a justice perspective, because when you have the last three presidents of the United States admitting openly to recreational marijuana use and having attained the highest office in the land, while we have unprecedented numbers of young, primarily men of color in our prisons and jails, where we incarcerate more people than any other country in the world and more people per capita than any other country in the world, something is deeply wrong. Our system is broken. That's why I'm so passionate about drug law reform.
You also mentioned your work to end the extreme use of solitary confinement. It's a serious problem here in California and in many states. The so-called SHUs, security housing units, are barbaric. And I don't know if you've ever been to the Louvre in Paris, but they have a 15th century dungeon at the very lowest level. It's about four elevator floors down. And that's the image I think of when I think of the modern security housing units that are used in the same way that dungeons, you know, with chains on the wall were used 500 or 600 years ago.
The solitary confinement practice is widespread in this country. And there was a startling New Yorker article that really spurred action in Maine several years ago that reported that Maine had more prisoners in solitary confinement than the entire country of Great Britain. And when you look at our prison statistics, we are far behind California and the other larger states. So we on the ground put together a coalition, and we worked, we brought legislation to limit the use of solitary confinement, because being locked up for 23 to 24 hours a day with no human contact, sometimes with the lights on for that whole time in a very small confined space, exacerbates mental illness where it already exists and creates mental illness. It literally drives people crazy. And so we define solitary confinement as a form of torture. And we challenged that first in the legislature and were unsuccessful. Then we started to put together a lawsuit, and the administration decided to go ahead and change its policies. And in that first year, we were able to reduce the use of solitary confinement by over 75% in Maine, which is hugely significant from a human rights perspective, but also from a fiscal perspective, because these practices, these extreme incarceration practices, are very expensive. So I'm very proud of that work. I think human rights is integral to who we are as a country. Our heritage has always valued human rights, and we need to work to promote human rights, and that means ending solitary confinement.
Let me turn to another barbaric trend in the United States, and that is the efforts to roll back reproductive rights, access to abortion, access to contraception. State after state has used Planned Parenthood as a political punching bag, and we now see a rise in sexually transmitted diseases, in unwanted pregnancies. 12 states have sharply restricted, if not practically eliminated, access to abortion services. And I'm highly critical of the Democratic Party in its failure to respond to this coordinated assault that's happening at the state level all across the country. And I'd love to see Wendy Davis elected the governor of Texas. But people act as if that's going to change the draconian rules in Iowa, in Kansas, the shutdown of Planned Parenthood clinics in Indiana. And I'm not seeing a call to arms by Democrats to protect what are very fragile and important rights of women that are being rolled back on a daily basis.
I'm passionate about women's reproductive freedom. I was a member of the Maine Choice Coalition for 9 years, and I led some of the battles in our legislature when Republicans took control in 2010, and we had a Republican governor, Paul LePage, who was very anti-choice.
Yeah, he makes Rick Perry look like an intellectual.
Our governor is. We're really glad that in 2014 we're going to replace him with Democrat Mike Nishu. But so I'm passionate about these issues, and I think we need leadership at the federal level. We need strong voices devoted to expanding access to contraception and abortion and fully supporting Planned Parenthood in its work. And this is another area where my opponent and I simply disagree. She has not always been terrible on reproductive rights, but recently she voted for the Blunt Amendment, which would allow employers to determine whether or not women have access to birth control. And that, I think, is unconscionable. Neither the government nor your boss should determine whether you have access to birth control or any healthcare service for that matter.
And can I expand that to include the Roman Catholic Church? Because they have embraced their own version of the Blunt Amendment, running a rear guard action, using the Little Sisters of the Poor as the plaintiff, the legal party, in this misguided action to declare that extending access to contraception violates their moral principles. No Little Sister of the Poor has ever been required to use birth control. And yet they act like providing that benefit to employees of the Little Sisters of the Poor violates their religious rights. That is so misguided, and it's irrational and incoherent, and it's also not based on any precedent. The Catholics have never made this claim before.
Well, you're touching on legal actions, and this is really important. The Supreme Court this year is going to hear the question of whether employers should be allowed to deny their employees access to birth control and other healthcare services based on the employer's religious views. I don't think employers should be able to impose their religious views on their employees, in the same way that I don't think the government should be able to impose religious views on any citizen. However, we have a Supreme Court that is very closely divided. And my opponent, Republican Susan Collins, voted to confirm Sam Alito and John Roberts. And we have a court that at all levels across this country has become increasingly conservative because of the Senate Republicans' role in confirming Bush nominees and in filibustering Obama nominees. And so we have a judiciary who has become so conservative that these rights are really in danger. And it's very concerning. We need strong, progressive Democrats because we need Democratic control of the United States Senate to ensure that whoever replaces Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg will be another strong progressive. And we need people who are willing to be champions for women's rights.
And Shenna, even after the drama of eliminating the filibuster or changing the cloture rules on judicial nominations, the Republicans are still using other tactics to slow down confirmations. And it's fair to say that Obama has not been putting the equivalent of Justice William Douglas onto the courts. He's making very centrist nominations, and even those are being blocked by Republicans. The net effect is we have a highly conservative judiciary, and it comes back to the court rulings on Guantanamo, on government spying, and the NDAA, which, Catherine Forrest issued a very courageous injunction on, and then it was overruled by an appeals court above her. And so we have a serious tilt to the right in the court system, and the two terms of Obama will not make a big difference in addressing or trying to reverse that shift.
The courts have been hostile not only to civil liberties and civil rights, but also to workers' rights, to the environment, and the Voting Rights Act. Having that partially struck down is alarming. So I think the trend is very worrying. It's one of the reasons I'm running. We need strong progressive Democrats who will push Obama and future presidents to nominate more progressive nominees to the judiciary.
Shenna, I told you before we started recording that I had the poor judgment to flip on the Rush Limbaugh radio show as I drove into the studio this morning. And he was on a rant where he was saying that because the Great Lakes have frozen over this winter, there's no climate change. And the polar blast or whatever that thing is called that has been freezing the central and eastern part of the country, they claim, look, there's no warming. Then he doubled down and started to talk about California. And he said that the drought here is man-made. It's due to water policy. That is flatly untrue. We've had the lowest rainfall in the last 13 months of any year on record. And yet he is willing to twist the truth to say that California's drought is man-made, but that the obvious climate change is not influenced by human behavior at all. So the deniers and the anti-science people really have gained momentum. And there's now a large group of Americans who are either confused or are tilting toward that view, that we don't need to reduce our carbon emissions because the whole science of climate change is a fraud.
Climate change is a serious threat to the planet. And I think that one of the challenges is it's such a looming crisis that it can be difficult for people to face. It's easier to pretend that it's not happening or to presume that it's so large it's not fixable. But in Maine, anyone who hunts or fishes, gardens or farms will tell you that the climate is changing and that the consequences to the environment and to the economy are potentially catastrophic. You know, here this winter in Maine, the shrimp industry, which is a winter industry, was closed because in the Gulf of Maine, we're experiencing warmer water temperatures that have been documented by Maine state geologists over time. We're experiencing acidification already. And as a result, the plankton population in Maine has diminished significantly, and the shrimp population crashed this winter. We are seeing, you know, I've been talking to farmers all across the state of Maine, and Maine is one of those great states where actually farming is enjoying a resurgence. There's a really strong farm-to-table movement here where local economies are really supporting local farmers. But the farmers are telling me that there are increased incidences of pests, that they're seeing erratic weather patterns not seen in prior years, and that that's making farming difficult as well. So in Maine, where our environment and our economy are so inextricably linked, we're seeing already the beginning impact of climate change. And that has a lot of people here on the ground very concerned and eager to take action. And that's why my opponent, Republican Susan Collins, who voted for the Keystone Pipeline twice, she had two opportunities to do the right thing and chose not to, is really not representing Maine interests. I've made climate change one of the top issues in my campaign because it's for future generations. This is for our children and our grandchildren's future.
So, Shenna, how do we reconcile the clear call to action the president has issued more than once, most recently in the State of the Union message, that he says climate change is a fact and we've got to deal with it, but his policies don't? He's dragging his feet on a decision on Keystone XL. His all-of-the-above energy policy has led to more offshore drilling. There are three new sites that have been opened up here in off the shore of California. We didn't learn a thing from the blowout in the Gulf of Mexico. Ernest Moniz, the new Secretary of Energy, is making a photo op appearance at the Vogtle Nuclear Power Plant in Georgia to make sure that everybody knows that we're using $6.5 billion of taxpayer money to guarantee the loans to build this nuclear power plant where Wall Street won't touch it, okay? And if the street isn't willing to loan money at interest to a public utility, then that tells us that the risk is too great. So I find the Obama energy policies hugely contradictory.
I think as a country, we're missing a huge opportunity here. This is an economic opportunity. We could pursue a fossil fuel-free economy with innovation in technology and investment in energies, clean energy, like solar and wind. It's a huge opportunity waiting for us. And Congress and the executive branch have been slow to act. So I think that it's one of the reasons I'm running. I don't think that we can afford to wait. I don't think we can continue. You know, I was studying economics and biology in college, and I wrote my thesis on environmental sustainability. And this, I graduated in 1997, almost 20 years ago. And we were talking about climate change then. And in the past 20 years, Congress has done little, almost nothing to really confront this problem in a significant way.
I'm a big fan of Bill McKibben. He's led the charge on the Keystone XL. Have we bet too much on one symbolic play? I understand that the reason it was selected is that it was purely up to the Obama administration. And it really was a litmus test as to whether Obama would use his authority in this roughly symbolic way. Because that tar sands oil is going to come in from Canada. It's also already being rolled in on rail cars, and Warren Buffett's profiteering on it. So have we invested too much in the Keystone XL battle?
I don't think so, because I think that the magnitude of the amount of tar sands oil that could be transported across the pipeline is such, and the projected emissions is so significant, that it is an important fight. And you do need clear goals in these complex issues. But I do think that it's even larger than that, and we need to think about investment in our local communities. I mean, Maine has a huge opportunity. When you look at Germany and what Germany has done with solar energy, and then you look at Maine, which actually has a higher solar incidence than Germany, we should be investing heavily in solar. And we should be doing that not just in Maine, but across this country. So there are many things that we can do to confront climate change and that are interconnected and beneficial to our environment and our economy. But stopping the Keystone Pipeline is important.
Nuclear power, your position?
I oppose nuclear power.
Mm-hmm. Can we dismantle the plants we have?
I think that we should. And what you'll see is that the life cycle of these plants is relatively short. There was a huge referendum fight in Maine in the early 80s around a nuclear power plant. And the nuclear power plant advocates won, and the power plant was installed. Well, today, about 30 years later, it's dormant. It's no longer producing power. It's no longer a useful facility. And the waste generated by that plant is something that we'll live with forever. So it's not sustainable over the long term. 30 years is not long enough. And for sure, there are some plants that have been operating for longer than that. But I don't think that nuclear power is a sustainable source of power for our future.
Mm-hmm. Let me turn to foreign policy. What is your perspective on the long-running conflict between Israel and Palestine and the U.S. role?
In Maine, we have something called Seeds of Peace, which is a program in the summertime where young people from Israel and Palestine come together, young people actually from different areas of conflict, come together to live and work together in Maine in this idyllic setting, and really get to know one another and understand one another. And when I was in high school, when I was 15, I was an exchange student to Brazil. And that for me was a life-changing moment. It started a passion in international food and culture and led to my service in the Peace Corps. But I think that what I learned in Brazil and what I learned in the Peace Corps in Panama is that we share a common humanity, and that there is more that unites us as people than divides us. So I am a proponent of a two-state solution, and I do think that we can achieve peace in the Middle East. And it's going to take a lot of work. It's going to take a significant amount of diplomacy and effort. But I'm optimistic about the future. And I'm optimistic because of programs like Seeds of Peace that we see, you know, working so well here on the ground in Maine.
In my view, one of the bright spots of Obama's foreign policy is the negotiations that are underway with Iran relative to its nuclear program. This week, as we're speaking, it's AIPAC week in Washington. And the new initiative from Israel is to try to up the ante with Iran and also address their missile program and try to eliminate or, I guess, reduce their stockpile of medium and long-range missiles. That's not what was on the table. This is mission creep in terms of these negotiations, and it could cause the talks to fall apart. And I'm curious if you have followed this issue, and if you do see a kind of escalation in demands that are originating in Israel that are mirrored in the United States Senate by Democrats like Menendez, who propose additional sanctions on Iran at the very time they have come to the table because of the sanctions of the past.
Menendez has been joined by my opponent, Republican Susan Collins, who is also backing this dangerous Iran sanctions bill that I do think could bring us closer to war. I think that negotiation is the best way forward to peace and security in the world. We cannot afford to be the world's military policeman anymore. We cannot afford these expensive wars. Wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have cost us so much, have cost the taxpayers at this point, some estimates say over $1 trillion. And for what? When you look at security in the region, we haven't made great progress. It's still very much in turmoil, very dangerous. And so when I see what people like my opponent, Republican Susan Collins, are advocating for with Menendez, it's very concerning. I will say that one of the great victories this year was Syria. So it looked like we were going to war in Syria. The president asked Congress for that authority, and it looked like that was going to happen. And yet people all across this country stood up, made their voices heard, wrote letters, made phone calls, and Congress backed down. And they decided not to intervene militarily. And that was the right decision.
Well, so I do see can I offer a different interpretation of that? Because, again, I feel that Obama held the right position on Syria until August. And then, because he had made what really was an offhand comment about the potential use of chemical weapons, and there was an incident where we still haven't proven who actually used chemical weapons in the Damascus suburb of Ghouta, the president, the vice president, and John Kerry went into hyperdrive and I think exercised very poor judgment, took us to the brink of war. And it was, you're correct that the American people broadly rejected that idea. But it was also a strange character named Vladimir Putin who came to our rescue with a plan to get Syria to relinquish its chemical weapons. So I thought that that was a very scary episode, but I thought it was really the low point in Obama's foreign policy.
I, too, disagreed with Obama's recommendation that we go in to Syria, and I think it was a mistake, and I was glad that disaster was averted. I was glad that he went to the Congress and to seek authorization, and heartened by the citizen action on that issue. You know, in Maine, a group of Republican state legislators actually wrote an open letter to Republican Susan Collins urging her to vote against military intervention. That's something that we hadn't seen before. You know, in the opposition to Iraq in the early days, that opposition was from the left and the left alone. And this fall, the opposition to war in Syria was from both the left and the right.
I'll just ask you, there's so many other fronts. We could go on for many hours. But the Republicans made a big deal out of Benghazi. And I believe there was a cover-up of the incident in Benghazi to protect the CIA and its secret operations at the facilities in Benghazi. But what gets lost in the all of the smoke that Republicans have generated about Benghazi is the ill-considered move by the U.S. and NATO to take out Gaddafi in the first place. And we have scene after scene now in the so-called Arab Spring, where we've nominally supported movements like in Egypt, only to see 2 years later the restoration of a military dictatorship. So coming back to Libya, did you support the intervention in the first place? And what is your comment about Benghazi?
How much time do we have?
Take your time. It's your schedule. I'm fine.
So I think that the Benghazi situation has become definitely a hot point on the right, and I think that it was poorly handled. But I don't pretend to have all of the facts. And I, you know, one of the challenges that gets lost sometimes is the challenge and the importance that we place on the Foreign Service and diplomacy and diplomatic interventions. So I don't know how to answer your question in its entirety.
Mm-hmm.
And what I do think, what I do believe, though, is that our foreign policy needs to focus on strategic diplomacy, that our role, and we need to work in coalition with other countries. We should not be making unilateral decisions, and we should not be making decisions based on the military first. We should be making decisions that are coming from the State Department and coming from a strategic perspective that is promoting peace. That's where we need to go.
All right. My final question for you, Shanna Bellows, relates to the use of unmanned aerial drones. And lately, the discussion has been, should the CIA run the program? Should the Pentagon run the program? And I don't believe that we should, impose an outright ban on the use of drones. But the way they've been expanded in their use in Pakistan and in Yemen in particular, I find very troubling, because in both countries, we don't have sufficient assets on the ground to identify the targets that we're taking out. And the most recent revelation from Ed Snowden's documents via Glenn Greenwald is that NSA has been using metadata to identify targets for drone strikes. And I find this very discomforting because, number one, you're targeting a cell phone, not an individual. There isn't even a minimal standard of probable cause or any a judicial proceeding that has identified this person as an enemy of the United States and created a legal basis for an attack on them. We talk about kill or capture. We've captured a couple, but we kill most of them. And I think that the blowback from the widespread use of drones in the lawless manner that I've just described is going to be something that we will pay a price for years to come. And I don't hear anybody discussing the big picture about how we use drones. There are these kind of micro arguments about whether the CIA should do the illegal killing or the Pentagon should do the illegal killing.
I think there's no question that the drone killing program has compromised our security. Family members of civilians who were killed by drone attacks came to this country to testify before Congress about the loss of their loved ones. And there are story after story coming out about the nature and extent of civilian casualties in the drone killing program. So I do think that it is very concerning to use metadata to target. I don't think that the program is targeted sufficiently. And I think that we really need to stop the drone killing program overseas at this juncture, because I don't think that it is effective for national security. It's certainly not promoting international peace. And I think it is very concerning that the president has claimed authority to target and kill American citizens with a drone without a hearing, without a trial, without a conviction. I think that due process and our justice system are so integral to the American tradition and rule of law. And I think, unfortunately, the drone killing program has fallen outside of the rule of law.
Shanna Bellows, can Susan Collins, by the way, I'm not related to her, can she be beaten?
Yes, absolutely. And we're taking a page out of the marriage campaign, and that is we're putting together an organized grassroots infrastructure all across the state of Maine. We actually raised more money than Susan Collins in our first quarter in the race. And we did so without any corporate PAC contributions.
Wow.
She received money from Citigroup and ExxonMobil. We didn't take any of that money. 80% of our contributions were from Maine. And we had over 1,000 Mainers give $5 checks, $50 checks, and sometimes, yes, a few of them $5,000 checks. We are very proud of our initial success. We think that shows energy and momentum on the ground. People are really struggling right now. We haven't talked as much about economic issues, but people are struggling economically. They're frustrated. They feel like Washington isn't listening to their concerns, and they're hungry for change. And Maine is a very progressive state, a state where the environmental movement is strong, the women's movement is strong, where we just passed same-sex marriage on the ballot. In some ways, our culture shares some in common with the progressive sympathies of Californians. And so I think that 2014 is a year where we're going to see an upset in Maine. We're going to turn Maine blue. And if your listeners are interested in helping, and they should be, they should check out our website, www.bellowsforsenate.com.
And are you aligned with my old pal, Shelley Pingree, and her daughter's in the state senate in Maine, too, right?
Shelley Pingree is wonderful, and she is helping me with my campaign. She's hosting a fundraiser for me. She is terrific, and we're lucky to have her in the Congress. And her daughter, Hannah, used to be Speaker of the House. She is a powerhouse herself. She and her husband are living on an island right now, raising two adorable children. She's taken some time out from electoral politics, but I think that we're going to see Hannah Pingree in leadership in the future, and that's really exciting. It's wonderful to have them as friends and colleagues in the state.
Well, I'm glad that we're seeing a real progressive candidate surface for the United States Senate this year. Thank you for putting up with my grueling questions here for a full hour. I'm going to share this podcast with a lot of our progressive friends, and I hope that people will focus on your campaign because I think it's really significant. And based on all the answers that you've provided here today, I would love to hear your voice in the United States Senate.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Say hallelujah. A real progressive is running for the United States Senate. I hope you'll spread the word. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until